I guess the first question that needs to be placed out there, and I want to emphasize that even though these guys are up here, this is meant to be a real give and take. And as Rusty pointed out, I need to pull in a lot of other people in the audience to comment as well. So stay awake, Larry. So can disease processes, I guess the very first question is, this is all fascinating science, but will it bring us any closer to figuring out drug treatments for patients? In other words, will a product come out of this that a physician can prescribe for a cardiomyopathy, or for an autism spectrum diseases, or that one can give for Alzheimer's disease? Can it be used as a quick way to determine, without having to doing animal testing or things of that sort, that a drug might have toxicity that's undesirable? So what I'd like to do is maybe throw open the very first question, which is, can a disease process be faithfully modeled in vitro? Is that possible, even though we've seen very interesting phenotypes? Maybe I'll ask Rusty just to comment on that first, and then we'll...
Well, I think the first question is whether or not embryonic stem cells can differentiate authentically into a cell in vitro that represents a cell in vivo. And how convincingly is that in vitro cell a surrogate for the function of the cell in vivo? I think we're still on track with that. I'm convinced that generically cells can differentiate into appropriate lineages and cell types. I think where we're still lacking in the field is generating now unique cell phenotypes. So you'd like to have not just neurons, but you'd like to have the neuron that is affected by the disease recapitulated in the dish. And I'm not certain whether or not we'll ever be able to do this with purified cells, that neuronal differentiation, for example, requires an entire environment. So this is going to require, if we want authenticity, to recapitulate not just the cells that are affected, but the environment that's infected, and certainly disease-wise, often the effects are generated from the environment onto the cell. So I think we still have a long way to go doing that. And that's just the biology. That'll tell us a lot about the biology of how neurons are generated. So we have to, and on the way to developing therapies, we get to learn a lot about human neurogenesis, human cell fate that we hadn't really had the opportunity to look at before. So this is a great biological tool as well. On the other hand, you're asking this in a very practical way. And the question that one might ask is, how authentic do you have to have the cell be in order for you to have a surrogate assay that you could screen or you could test that might be useful? So maybe on the way to fully differentiating a cell into an authentic neuron of a particular phenotype, you may be able to use the culture conditions to determine or tease out what might be different between the host cell and the mutant cell or the disease cell, and then use that surrogate to screen for drugs, even though that might not replicate exactly what's going on in vivo. So I think we just don't know that yet. But I think we're sort of on the road, and the question is how fully can we recapitulate differentiation in a dish, and how important is that full differentiation for teasing out what the phenotype might be?
It seems like that hurdle is higher if you're, going to replace a tissue, right? Whereas if we're going to do drug screening, then, for example, for the talk I gave, if we do better than the current cell models, then we've made an advance. And so it's more about doing as good as we can. And if you're gonna replace some heart tissue, then it seems like the bar's a little higher.
Yeah. No, I think that from my perspective, this is really an opportunity to learn something about the biology of how these cells develop as much as it is. And maybe that's a precursor to developing an accurate model of what's going on. But you're right, I think for screening, you may have a lower bar than it is for cell transplantation. But I think we're all talking here about really in vitro screening and not transplantation, which I think is a different objective.
Did you want to make some other comments on that, Jeff, as well? I mean, it sounds like you have a reasonable phenotype. That, in fact, do you think that would you, as a let's say a regulatory agency, feel comfortable using now this in vitro model to screen drugs as opposed to animal studies?
Yeah, I think you know, compared to putting a hERG receptor in a cancer cell line that doesn't even have a contractile apparatus, which is kind of what I understand the front line screening that's being done now at most drug companies. This seems like a much more complete model for testing arrhythmias, and it has a much better chance of replicating the behavior of what you would see in vivo than, you know, cells that are even more tortured, I guess, right, that are cell lines. And I think that, you know, this instrument is relatively new, so what we'd like to do with this instrument is help characterize physiologically the states of the cells. So I know that Mark's group has already been doing some experiments that show that it's pretty easy to tell the difference between atrial and ventricular cardiomyocytes using the contraction waves. You know, they contract differently. And you can see the pacemaker cells because they beat spontaneously first, and then there are other characteristics of them as well. So I think we're providing kind of a physiological measurement, and then there are all of the other important questions of what channels are actually causing those contractions, because we're really looking at kind of an integrated output of all of the biology underlying the contractile apparatus, including a whole bunch of different you know, potassium, sodium, calcium channels of different types. So understanding that underlying biology is it's much more complicated than what we're seeing in a single calcium contraction. And so we can read it out and then maybe infer what might be happening, and then those other experiments have to be done to understand exactly what's generating the arrhythmia or what's generating the difference between an atrial and a ventricular cardiomyocyte, for example.
So, Evan, Larry has a comment. Could I just interject one thing, though, just from this, before you go to this, from this piece that's in the November 26th, as I said, issue of Science. There's a couple of comments. One's from Jamie Thompson. I think this is on some of your points, Evan, who cautions that researchers don't yet fully understand the variation in IPS lines. If two lines behave differently, it's difficult to tell whether that's because of disease-relevant genetic differences or random differences introduced into the reprogramming process, although newer techniques are helping. So the variability is an issue there, which I think it goes to a couple of your points as well. And then there was a sidebar, Jeff, on a comment from Christine Mummery, developmental biologist at Leiden University Medical Center, saying that it takes roughly $2 billion and 10 years to get a drug to market, and despite that, we're still getting drugs on the market with cardiac side effects. So that's your point again, isn't it?
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Anyway, Larry.
You know, one thing I would point out when you ask a question like that is it presupposes that the goal is to have a perfect mimic of a disease phenotype in order to find a useful therapeutic agent. But if you were to ask the question, what are we comparing this to? The fact is that in conventional pharmaceutical drug discovery for a number of disorders like ALS and Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's, conventional discovery pathways have A, not yielded anything, and B, have used models that are, in my view, far inferior to what we're talking about here. And so the goal may not so much be get the perfect disease model as it is get a better disease model than what we're currently using so that we can potentially accelerate the progress of agents to clinical use.
Yeah, to answer your question directly, we're seeing differences in the responses of different batches of cardiomyocytes to arrhythmogenic drugs. And one hypothesis there is it's just a difference in maturation. So, you know, just controlling the amount of time the cardiomyocytes are allowed to mature in culture before we look at them make a big change in their responsiveness.
Evan, I just wondered if it's a valid question to ask at this time. I mean, I think there's a validation process that's really necessary. You've got a whole history of use of drugs in animals and humans, and what they should be done at some point in time is show validly that you can prevent or stop or change using your disease in a dish. And that validation, I think, would be incredibly important. But, I mean, the other way of thinking about it is, well, maybe it doesn't matter about validation. If you find a drug and then you put it through the sort of normal, you know, tests that a pharmaceutical company would do, do you really get to the end there? I'd suggest the validation would be a really helpful way of doing things, because it's a reverse translation thought, and it's using a lot of data that's already been generated. I don't know whether panelists think that that's important or not, but I always thought it was the best way to go once you've got, you know, such a disease in a dish.
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent point. In fact, it was something I was going to bring up that, you know, for example, Jeff's phenotype is very near term to what the problems would be in the actual patient. You see arrhythmias in the dish. Presumably, that can induce an arrhythmia in an actual patient. With some of the neurologic diseases, that connection is a little bit more tenuous. And I was going to ask Mason maybe, and maybe Larry as well, to comment on. So let's say you model extra expression of A-beta, and now you actually have a drug that alters that in a dish. Do you now have a drug for an Alzheimer's patient?
Right. I do think iPS technology can be used to validate a drug. For example, gamma secretase inhibitors, they lower A-beta, and there's been many failed clinical trials. And we don't know why they failed. We don't know if it's just because we're not giving the drugs to the patients early enough. Maybe we have to give the drug when their disease is, you know, less fully developed. So I think iPS technology might be able to answer that really important question, how early in the pathogenesis do we have to start giving the disease? So in a way, I think that's, is that what you're talking about? I think that's one way we can validate drugs in Alzheimer's disease.
Obviously, and you know, Larry can comment on that too. Alzheimer's is a very controversial disease. You know, it still remains controversial whether decreasing A-beta levels is what one needs to reverse the disease or inhibit the disease. With autism spectrum disorder, the fascinating findings that Rusty described on spines, can one connect what one sees in the dish to what the symptomatology of a girl with Rett syndrome is? So that gets to the validation that you were talking about.
We've got a couple of more here, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. This question is for Mason and Ilyas. Interesting data. However, I am making these disease models, these disease in a dish models. How compelling is it to draw conclusions from, say, two patients? Or three patients. Have these experiments been replicated? Is it very hard to get these patients? Could you go comment on this process?
Right. I mean, ideally, we would study many more patients, especially with the sporadic form of Alzheimer's disease. It's just right now the technology is so new, and you know, I did all these experiments myself. It's all I could do. But let me tell you. But at least now we have some hint that it's working. So now we can do a much larger experiment. And then I also want to remind you that for each one of these patients, I studied three independently derived iPS lines. For each patient, I was able to, you know, I do feel pretty confident for each patient, but now in the lab where we have new grad students in the lab that are going to expand, yeah. So that's work to come.
So one of the advantages also is that these are renewable resources. So you can,
graduate students.
Yeah,
that too.
The cells are renewable, so if you're interested, you can receive the cells and replicate these same experiments using the same protocols in your lab, and that's one of the real advantages going forward, and I think it's something that will allow for an increased number of subjects in each one of these diseases, and something that CIRM actually, I think, is considering getting involved in is banking cells, so that as all these cells are being made from different laboratories, so one lab isn't making 100 subjects, but if you pool them from a variety of different investigators into a single source, then different people can access them for different types of experiments, and that's where you get replication and all the other sorts of things that you need to have.
Yeah, Elise, did you want to comment on replicability of the phenomena plus validation?
So I personally believe really that we really have to improve our tool set and make this process of neural differentiation, so not only neural induction, but also neural patterning, terminal differentiation, more controlled and defined. And that's also the reason why we basically went back and you know, left embryonic bodies aside and really wanted something that we can do every time in the defined condition. And now having this starting point with these earliest neural stem cells, we think we can now develop systematically better protocols to make GABAergic cells, dopaminergic cells, motor neurons, et cetera, or glial cells. So based on my experience, so I'm actually, I did single-handedly generate more than 50 iPS cell lines of different patients with diseases, et cetera. And looking at all these cell lines, we see lots of variability in their outcome. And the lack is simply also, we don't have functional assays to, we see differences if we look at microarrays comparing different iPS cell lines, but what does it mean? If an iPS cell line nicely differentiates and gives you the phenotype, you can definitely go and model disease in a dish. But again, these differences could be very subtle. And then if you use a neural induction paradigm I've shown here, and all cells go to PAX6 positive cells, this could be actually a good assay to say how good are these cells in differentiating to the neural lineage. So for one tendency, for example, is if we generate iPS cell lines that are very slow growers, we don't know why. So these cells in general also don't differentiate well, right? So comparing to H9 cells, for example. So you want to really find ways to make it more defined and controlled. So this is our experience with that.
Yeah. We have to go to a break shortly, but I can be tempted to walk up and come into beyond the first rows if any of you got any interesting questions. But let me ask you, this is David Brenner. So you're running a medical school. I mean, you see all this sort of stuff. What's the response with patients and so on? How much enthusiasm?
I'm always enthusiastic. No, I think this will be a breakthrough. I think the idea you can model, start with patient material and model disease in a dish will change the paradigm for doing biomedical research. And my only question or sort of comment is that how generalizable is it? You know, if Rusty took patients who were not Rett syndrome but had autism for other reasons, do you reproduce the same phenotype? Is it going to be available to not these very unique patients, but to more the field in general? But my initial gestalt is just incredible, enthusiasm for this field.
That's why we chose this particular disease, because it has a known mutation. So that becomes the baseline from which to compare to the other autism spectrum diseases, because you have a disease with a known mutation, and then you can take wild-type cells, knock out that gene, and show that it can recapitulate the phenotype of the disease. So we're cheating a little bit, but it allows us to move into the field.
One question, naive question. In our body, the tissue, every tissue, the softness is different. The stiffness of the tissue is different from one tissue to the other. So my question is, when people use the dish to grow iPS to induce the different phenotype, then a dish is very, very stiff. The rigidity is very high. So it's quite different from tissue. So should one consider to change the rigidity of the dish to culture iPS.
But you want to respond?
Well, yeah, no, I think that what you're raising is a really important point, and this is where the merger of biology with bioengineering is really taking front row and trying to model using material sciences to simulate more accurately. And there are some wonderful bioengineers now that are taking this idea of tension and stretch and building it, modeling it in vivo. We know that in our case, we don't get full maturation of the cells with appropriate spines without culturing with other cell types, for example, with astrocytes, on the surface of astrocytes. So there is a cooperation there, a cell cooperation that reveals itself simply by co-culturing with astrocytes. So knowing more about these biophysical principles, I think, is going to be crucial.
Evan, there's another question up here.
Sure, okay.
As probably the only veterinarian, or one of the few veterinarians at this conference, most of the side effects that come from therapies are generally not from the cell itself. They're usually like you have renal toxicities. I was recently treating a Doberman Pinscher with dilated cardiomyopathy who was responding swimmingly, just outstanding. I was ecstatic. What happened is he's now dead. He died of it, unfortunately. What happened is he had what I believe was an acute cortotendony rupture that stopped cardiac output, and he was put down. I didn't get to necropsy him, unfortunately. My concern about this is if we get the dish or the tail wagging the dog, we may have some serious, serious issues that are unpredictable, and we may lurch a little too forward too fast as we believe that our dish is really the reality. I mean, how many molecular biologists have told us, well, I did it in vivo, I did it in a dish. Remember that comment?
Are there other questions?
I think you can't sort of leave it like that. I think whenever there's new technology that's developed, there's a light that shines on, everybody sort of sees that's the answer. I think it's better to think of this as a new addition to the arsenal of tools that are out there. And the big question, of course, is when one does screen, if one can model the disease, you screen for compounds that look like they may have an effect reversing it, what's the next step? And we haven't really talked about that. Would you go directly from, your implication would be that somehow they'd screen these cells in a dish and go directly into patients. And I can't imagine that would actually happen. Toxicity and other things have to be done. So rather than thinking of this as a alternative path, that it's an additional tool in the arsenal of basic scientists to understand fundamental processes and perhaps contribute to drug screening, but it's not going to supplant existing strategies. Yeah.
Well, that does get to the point about where in the whole drug discovery scheme does this fit, and it sounds like validation is very important. We haven't addressed the question of whether, and that was kind of alluded to, that the very act of culturing cells, particularly if it's not done precisely the right way or perhaps reprogramming, could change what we're investigating, which brings up Alan's point about validation. And then the last question that maybe somebody should comment on is, what is the best cell? Larry's going to comment. Okay.
Again, yeah. Sorry. I can't help it. So I think I would reframe this question again that was brought up, because the question is, can you solely on the basis of animal models predict all kinds of toxicity that you might encounter in humans, and can you predict efficacy? But if you look at why drugs fail, they fail in clinical trials often because of unexpected toxicities in the human that were not revealed in animal testing. And I'll point out, I've seen drugs that did not progress to clinical trials because they were toxic in some species of animal and probably would not have been toxic in humans, but you didn't dare put them in humans because of the toxicity, in this case, in dogs. And so it's not, is the dish sufficient? The question is, can you begin to build human models that will gradually supplant animal models for efficacy, toxicity, and other problems? And will that improve the clinical trial success rate? Because I guarantee you, if you change the failure rate from 9 in 10, which is what it currently is, entering trials, to 8 in 10, it changes the industry and the drug development paradigm completely.
All right. Thank you very much. And I guess we have a break now, correct?